sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is a fascinating Israeli woman, Roni Kedar, whose life journey has taken her from London to the Sinai, to Egypt, to the area near Gaza, and who seeks to build peace in the shadow of rockets. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Spring is definitely here now, and Passover's absolutely over. And as we returned our home kitchen to its year-round chametz status, we discovered, as we do every single year, that we had lots of boxes of uneaten matzah. You know, you buy the 5-pound collection of matzah boxes because it's a much better deal, and you need a couple of boxes for Seder anyway, and then you end up with 2 or 3 boxes left at the end of Passover, just when you really don't want to see matzah again for a very long time. So, what to do? Just how do you use up all those boxes of the unleavened bread of intestinal affliction? Well, to play us in this morning, in her now 5-year-old classic song, Michelle Citrin tells you the 20 things you can do with matzah after Passover's over.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate?
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citrin's 20 Things to Do with Matzah After Passover's Over. Well, since Passover's over, that means we're now in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Pesach, the festival of freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of covenant and Torah. For the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuos, we take a few moments each evening to say a blessing and count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our Brit, our great covenant with God, certified at Mount Sinai. As a passage in the book of Proverbs says, teach us to number our days so that we may make each day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us that we have the capacity to make every single day matter, to bring holiness into our lives every 24 hours. In the Sfirat HaOmer, the prayer that we chant each night, there's a famous passage. Sheyabona Beit HaMikdash Bimhera V'Yamenu. May the temple be rebuilt speedily in our day. It's a classic text, but more than that, it's a metaphor for what we wish for in our own lives at this time of year. May we continually seek to rebuild ourselves, our communities, and our world. Sheyabonah Beis Hamikdash, as sung by Cantor Ben Sion Miller. Sheyabonah Beis Hamikdash, a classic concert piece sung by Chazan Ben Sion Miller, a true cantorial tenor for the period of the counting of the Omer from now until Shavuot. When we come back on Two Jewish This Morning, we'll meet our guest, the fascinating Israeli Roni Kedar, who started life in London, moved to Sinai when it was still part of Israel, subsequently moved to Egypt with her husband, and then on to the border near Gaza in Israel, where she lives and works today. Hear her fascinating story when we come back on Two Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Craig difference.
Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help make quality Jewish education available to local students in need of financial support by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO. Here's how it works. Arizona allows taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized organizations like JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to children who attend local Jewish schools in Tucson. These tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you make a contribution to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit, which means that your Arizona state income tax is reduced or your refund is increased up to the amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. You have until April 15th to make your contribution for the 2012 tax year. To foster Jewish education today, give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. Or go online to JETCO.org. By making a tax credit contribution to JETCO, you help nurture Jewish identity in Tucson for new generations of students like me. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Roni Kedar. She was born in England, lived in the northern Sinai, in an area that was actually given back to Egypt in the peace treaty, the Camp David peace treaty. Moved at one point to Egypt, where she lived for a while, and then came back and lives really just outside of Gaza, in an area that experiences, sadly, a great deal of attack from terror. So you have a knack for being in interesting places at interesting times. Tell us, was this by choice or beshert?
Well, let's say we got to the place we're living today because when we had to leave the Sinai in accordance with the peace treaty with Egypt, we knew that we wanted to be as close as we could to our original village without being on negotiable land again. And this was, we were quite adamant about. And we chose this place, which is really exactly inside the internationally recognized borders of Israel. So it was by choice, most definitely. We thought we were coming to the same type of agriculture. We were slightly mistaken. We have to invest so much more in everything we grow, but we are a very strong, supportive community and very successful where we are today.
Tell us a little bit about the experience, which is, you know, not totally unique to you, but very unusual for Americans to hear about, of living in an area in the Sinai where you had an agricultural settlement, you were building a future in the Sinai, which was, after all, controlled by Israel from 1967 up until 1982 or so, and then to be uprooted for the cause of peace. Tell us what that experience is like.
Well, first of all, when we first knew that we were going to have to move, it was it didn't go together with our concept of peace. Why does peace have to go with being uprooted from our homes, uprooted our plantations? Some cried out, some demonstrated. We tried to put over a message that there must be another way. But as soon as we realized that there was no other way, and it was either peace or staying in our home in Sinai, it was obvious which course we had to take. And that was when we made the move.
Now, when you move to a place, you never know what's going to happen in the future. Gaza was very peaceful for quite a long time. Nobody can remember that time anymore, but it was a long time where there really wasn't any challenge. When did things start to get dicey there?
About 12 years ago. I think the first suicide bombers, every now and then there were closure on Gaza because we were afraid of people coming across in order to attack. at that time, to be honest, the most fearful times living so close was when they were in closure, because I thought people being bored without anything to do, with a lot of frustration.
And by closure you mean the borders closed, there's exactly. No economic stuff going on, basically interdicted.
Exactly. And but then from time to time they would open the borders again and people would come. Many of them worked for us on the village. We had a very good relationship with these people, so I do know it's possible. I think that's about it.
We will talk much more with Rani Kedar about her very interesting experiences and about connecting with people in challenging circumstances when we come back on To Jewish.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a comment, question, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. This morning, we have an important story to tell you, one that connects this week of the year, President Obama's trip to Israel, a recent death, and events that took place almost 7 decades ago. And all of it connects through a guy you may never have heard of, but should have. It was in this time of year, April 11th, 1945, to be exact, 68 years ago this week, General George Patton's Third Army had liberated the Buchenwald concentration camp about an hour before. A young rabbi, Herschel Schachter, attached to the Third Army's 7th Corps, was the first Jewish chaplain to enter just after the first wave of American troops. And therein lies a tale. Actually, several tales. After learning that Patton's forward tanks had arrived at Buchenwald, Rabbi Schachter, who died last week in the Bronx at the age of 95 after a career as one of the most prominent modern Orthodox rabbis in the U.S., commandeered a jeep and a driver. He left headquarters, and the young rabbis sped toward the concentration camp. When he drove through the gates, Allied tanks had breached its walls. He remembered the sting of smoke in his eyes, the smell of burning flesh, and hundreds of bodies strewn everywhere. Schachter remained at Buchenwald for months, tending to survivors, leading religious services in a former Nazi recreation hall, and eventually helping resettle thousands of Jews. On that first April day, it seemed as though there was nobody left alive. In the camp, Rabbi Schachter encountered a young American lieutenant who knew his way around already. "Are there any Jews alive here?" the rabbi asked him. Schachter was led to the Kleine Lager, or little camp, a smaller camp within the big one. There, in filthy barracks, men lay on raw wooden planks stacked from floor to ceiling. They stared down at the rabbi in the unfamiliar military uniform with unmistakable fright. "Shalom Aleichem, Yidden," Rabbi Schachter cried in Yiddish. "Ihr seid frei." "Peace be upon you, Jews. You are free." He ran from barracks to barracks, repeating these words again and again and again. He was eventually joined by those Jews who could still walk until a stream of people began to swell behind Rabbi Schachter. As he passed a mound of corpses, the rabbi spied a flicker of movement. Drawing closer, he saw a little boy, prisoner 17030, hiding in terror behind the mound. "I was afraid of him," the child recalled long afterwards. "I knew all the uniforms of the SS and the Gestapo and the Wehrmacht. All of a sudden, a new kind of uniform, I thought, a new kind of enemy." With tears streaming down his face, Rabbi Schachter picked the boy up. "What's your name, my child?" he asked in Yiddish. "Lulek," the child replied. "How old are you?" the rabbi asked. "What difference does it make?" Lulek, who was 7, said. "I'm older than you, anyway." "Why do you think you're older?" Rabbi Schachter asked, smiling. "Because you cry and laugh like a child," Lulek replied. "I haven't laughed in a long time, and I don't even cry anymore. So which one of us is older?" Rabbi Schachter discovered nearly 1,000 orphaned children in Buchenwald. He and a colleague, Rabbi Robert Marcus, helped arrange for their transport to France, a convoy that included the little boy Lulek and a teenager named Elie Wiesel, as well as one to Switzerland in a group that Schachter personally conveyed, and others went on to Palestine. For decades afterwards, Rabbi Schachter said, he remained haunted by his time in Buchenwald, by the questions survivors put to him as he raced through the camp that first day. "They were asking me over and over, 'Does the world know what happened to us?' And I was thinking, 'If my own father had not caught the boat on time, I would have been there too.'" Rabbi Herschel Schachter passed away last week. His biography was typical of many American Jews of his generation. Born in Brooklyn in 1917, he grew up in a large first-generation immigrant family. Eventually, he got his bachelor's degree from Yeshiva University in New York. In 1941, he was ordained at Yeshiva by Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, major founder of modern Orthodoxy. He spent about a year as a pulpit rabbi in Connecticut before enlisting in the army as a chaplain in 1942. And after 3 years in the service, he came to Buchenwald. After Buchenwald was liberated, Schachter spent every day there distributing matzah. This liberation had come, like this year, just a week after Pesach, leading services for Shavuot, conducting Friday night services each week. At one of those services, Lulek and his older brother Naftali were able to say Kaddish for their parents, Polish Jews murdered by the Nazis. Schachter was discharged from the army with the rank of captain. He became the spiritual leader of the Mosholu Jewish Center, an Orthodox synagogue on Hull Avenue in the Bronx, from 1947 until the synagogue closed in 1999. Schachter went on to lead many national Jewish groups, including the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations. And what about Lulek, the orphan that Rabbi Schachter rescued from Buchenwald? Lulek eventually settled in Palestine, grew up to be Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel from 1993 to 2003, now the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. When Rabbi Lau met with President Obama at Yad Vashem a couple of weeks ago at the Great Holocaust Memorial Center in Jerusalem, he told the American president of his rescue by Rabbi Schachter. And he thanked the American people for delivering Buchenwald survivors not from slavery to freedom, but from death to life. But at that time, he did not yet know that Rabbi Schachter had died just the day before. "For me," Rabbi Lau said, "he was alive." May the memory of Rabbi Herschel Schachter and the work he did at Buchenwald and throughout his long rabbinical career continue to remain alive. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy, good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So we've had lots of wonderful fun celebrations, Pesach, Memuna at the end. Now a very serious one tomorrow, begins tonight, Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Amazingly important in Israel for a long time. Is it still?
It is. I think, you know, Holocaust commemoration and the Zikaron Shel HaShoah is something that is very much alive in Israel. Every family you meet knows someone who've lost, who've either lost their loved ones or was closely related to someone who died during the Holocaust. One of the interesting points about the Holocaust, many people falsely believe in the U.S. or in other places, that Israel was created as a result of the Holocaust. But historically, it was the other way around. The Zionist movement have been working to create a sovereign Jewish state way before World War II. And the idea was to encourage Jews from Europe, mainly from Eastern Europe, to immigrate and go back to our homeland, to Israel. And to much degree, the Holocaust was the biggest threat on the possibility of creating a Jewish state, because most of the Jews that were supposed to become the citizens of this state were perished during the Holocaust. So it's kind of counter to the common narrative. A lot of people think, oh, there was the Holocaust and then the UN met and all the, sorry for the phrase, all the Gentiles had their conscience, so they had to vote in favor of Israel, and that's how the Jewish state came to be. But in reality, the vote of the UN didn't have nearly any effect on truly creating a Jewish state. What made the Jewish state be was all the infrastructures of the Jewish community, of the Moshav, in the land of Israel, and of course the ability to survive the independence war, despite having a lot of Holocaust survivors that just came back from Europe and had to go into the battlefield to protect Israel. yet the memory of the Holocaust is something very strong in the identity of Israel. And I would say one of the major reasons that we need to remember why we should have a Jewish state, you know, even today, we can't, as a Jewish people, we can't afford not to have a Jewish state, a Jewish army, a Jewish flag.
Very important lesson, and it never more clear than at the time when we commemorate the Shoah, Yom HaShoah, the Day of Holocaust Remembrance. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Yei Zichron Baruch.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and welcome back.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You have just returned on a nearly 50-hour journey from Israel. What observations?
Right. Well, first of all, let me say that so this year, the day before Chag Sheni, the end of Pesach, coincided with Easter Sunday, and there were Jews and Christians from all over the world. Right. And every once in a while, also Ramadan falls at the same time. So then there's lots of Muslim pilgrims from all over the world as well. That wasn't the case this year, but there were plenty of others. And there was a lot of opportunity to watch people of various faiths interacting, and especially people from all over the world who all consider Jerusalem a very special, holy place. But my sort of favorite scene, and the one that really gives me the most hope for the future and for a possible peace. I mean, first of all, I was there right after Obama's visit, and it was, people were in a very upbeat mood. Sure. Because they thought Obama did the right thing in directly addressing the youth. They thought that a man who had been wrongly portrayed as an enemy of Israel really showed clearly that he was not only a friend, but a concerned and committed friend. They were in a very upbeat mood. Obama's visit was a great success from the point of view of most Israelis, not to mention the rapprochement with Turkey, which is very important for regional politics, and which we've discussed before on the show. But the scene I like the best is, I go with a friend who lives there, who grew up with me in St. Louis, to what used to be the Hyatt Hotel near the Hebrew University campus.
Oh, I've stayed there.
Right. Okay. And it's full of people from all over the world.
Sure.
It is in technically East Jerusalem.
I guess,
So it's in like a very mixed neighborhood. You go through Arab neighborhoods to get there, and it's kind of on the dividing line between a Jewish neighborhood and an Arab neighborhood. But it's health club, where my friend goes 5 days a week, and usually I pay the stiff visitor's fee, and it's like, you know, $30 or something, but you get access there. And the reason I go is that it's one of the few scenes in Jerusalem where Jews and Arabs are interacting in a very civil way, in very polite ways. There are both Jews and Arabs on the staff, among the clients. There are Christian Arab ladies who are not overly covered. There are Muslim Arab guys lifting weights, and people are interacting like B'nai Adam, like nice, polite people, and recalls the days of civility of the Ottoman Empire, for example, when all these diverse groups coexisted peacefully and harmoniously. And it's in private settings like that, and a lot of my friends there work in various fora where young Palestinians and Israelis cooperate in like a youth orchestra or something, where ordinary people get along very peacefully. They recognize that there are differences. They don't close their eyes to the differences, but there's no antagonism, there's no hostility, there's no rhetoric. And it sort of goes to the point about, take politics out of the hands of politicians and put it in the hands of normal people, and you have a much better world.
From your mouth to God's ears, as we say in my business. It's a good thought and brings additional hope for Israel as we get close to the 65th birthday.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Little David returned home from Hebrew school, and his father asked, "What'd you learn today?" And David answered, "The rabbi told us how Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt." "Oh, that's great, David," his dad said. "How'd he do it?" So David said, "Well, Moses was this gigantic, strong guy, and he beat the heck out of Pharaoh. Then, while Pharaoh was lying on the ground, Moses got all the people together and they ran to the sea. When they got there, Moses had the Corps of Engineers build a huge pontoon bridge. When they got to the other side, they blew up the bridge while the Egyptians were on it trying to cross." His father was shocked. "Is that what the rabbi told you?" The boy replied, "Nah, but you'd never believe the story he did tell us." That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Tazria Metzora in the book of Leviticus, and a wholly unappetizing set of portions it is indeed. Metzora in particular focuses on the question of leprosy, a dread disease of the ancient world, but mostly an archaic and pretty disgusting section for us today. It's true that leprosy was an awful thing and needed to be eliminated if at all possible, in particular by using the concept of quarantines to isolate it, but exploring what our ancestors believed to be an infectious disease at great length in a Shabbat service can scarcely be called spiritually meaningful. The rabbis of our tradition recognized this problem long ago and came up with an ingenious and meaningful reinterpretation. The word metzorah, which means leprosy, was itself, they said, an abbreviation for the term in Hebrew, motzi shem ra, which means slander or evil speech. The ways in which we employ language lead to many of the worst problems in society, they said. Evil speech, the rabbis teach, is not only a terrible epidemic disease, but even a multiple murderer, killing three people. The one who shares the gossip, the one who hears the gossip, and the one who is the subject of the gossip. According to Jewish law, even gossip that has a kernel of truth within it is lashon hara and inherently wrong, and causes intense societal damage. Some authorities, such as the great rabbi known as the Chofetz Chaim, go so far as to say that even gossiping about truth is morally heinous. There is an interesting parallel in our own law code in the U.S. The legal concept in American jurisprudence is called the fruit of the poisoned tree. It rules out the use of evidence collected improperly, that is, any discovery gathered in such a way is tainted and not legally admissible. So it is with metzorah and all other forms of lashon hara, evil speech. Whether the gossip has elements of truth in it or not, it is derived from a fundamentally corrupted source. Our moral goal in life should be to completely eliminate from our lives and habits motzi shem ra, the awful tendency we have to speak ill of others. The rabbis teach that if you commit no slander, your own life can become clean of moral illness. By purifying our speech of words that are damaging to others, we find our way clear to living better, holier lives. In the portion this week, it even delineates forms of metzorah that affect the very houses in which we live, metzorah at bayit. If a house is badly enough infected with this leprosy of the property, it may even need to be destroyed. It's along the lines of Abraham Lincoln's concept that a house divided against itself cannot stand. If we wish to have not only personal lives, but houses, that is, organizations, synagogues, communities, in which holiness can really flourish, the dreadful sin of slander must be eliminated. May we each do our part, now and always, to remove metzorah, personal impurities of speech, from our own lives. When we come back on Too Jewish, our fascinating guest, Roni Kedar, will explore what it takes to make peace when rockets are landing in your own town, and why that's not a dreamer's approach, when we return on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A question. Will the Israeli authorities now add Kaddish to the list of Jewish prayers and ritual observances that women are not allowed to perform at the Western Wall? In a March 14th letter to Anat Hoffman, chairman of the Women of the Wall and a past guest of Two Jewish, Jerusalem Police Chief Yossi Parienti wrote that he met with a deputy attorney general for the government of Israel to go over the rules pertaining to Women of the Wall, which include prohibitions on wrapping yourselves in talitot, holding a minyan of women, including the Kaddish or Kedusha prayers, and reading from the Torah. The police chief warns that starting on Rosh Chodesh this month, falls this week, April 11th, the Women of the Wall will be arrested and charged with breaking the law for doing any of these things. On hearing about the letter, the Jewish Agency's chairman, Natan Sharansky, rushed to meet with Rabbi Shmuel Rabinovich, chairman of the Western Wall Kotel Heritage Foundation, to express shock. Sharansky is currently in the final stages of drafting recommendations for Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to decrease tensions and ensure that every Jew in the world can pray at Judaism's most important national and religious site. In recent days, Sharansky has met with a number of ministers in Israel's new government and is in the last round of discussions with leading religious and public figures in the Jewish world and, of course, in Israel. Sharansky has said that the growing tensions at the Western Wall highlight the need to find a solution. The Kotel must continue to be a symbol of unity for all Jews in the world and not a symbol of strife and discord, Sharansky said. While the letter from the police chief stated that the police would arrest women who recite Kaddish, Rabbi Rabinovich privately assured Sharansky, well, I guess maybe it was publicly, that contrary to the letter, no woman will actually be arrested for saying Kaddish at the Western Wall. Well, if the police chief's new threat is nonetheless put into practice this week, it is an overreach, Hoffman said. It's chutzpah, unbelievable chutzpah. Police have increasingly arrested Women of the Wall members during their prayers at the Kotel, an experience that goes back 30 years, by the way. Most recently, the police arrested some of the Women of the Wall in February and back in December of 2012. After detaining the Women of the Wall members at the Kotel, sometimes for a few hours, occasionally overnight, police have generally released them after they signed a statement agreeing not to return to the Kotel for a month. Police backed down from arresting members at the last Rosh Chodesh service when they were informed that three of the women were members of Knesset and therefore have legal immunity. Some 300 women participated in the last Rosh Chodesh service, Hoffman said. She expects that many to attend on April 11th. In other news from and about Israel, in the wake of President Obama's visit to Israel, 100 prominent American Jews sent a letter to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, urging him to work closely with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to devise pragmatic initiatives consistent with Israel's security needs, which will represent Israel's readiness to make painful territorial sacrifices for the sake of peace. The letter was initiated and organized by the Pro-Peace Israel Policy Forum, delivered last week to the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem and the Israeli Embassy in Washington. The Jewish leaders call on Netanyahu to take concrete confidence-building measures designed to demonstrate Israel's commitment to a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Signatories on the letter include many well-known philanthropists like Charles Bronfman, Lester Crown, and Stanley Gold, former U.S. Undersecretary of Defense Dov Zakheim, former U.S. Congressman Mel Levine, former AIPAC Executive Director Tom Dine, Holocaust scholar Deborah Lipstadt, President of the Union for Reform Judaism Rabbi Rick Jacobs, and his predecessor Rabbi Eric Yaffe, and a number of other prominent Jews from all across the Jewish spectrum. Rabbi Rick Jacobs said, "It was clear to me that President Obama's trip was historic. It would be beneficial to both the U.S. and Israel to build on the momentum created by that trip to look for fresh ways to create a way to move beyond the logjam of the current Israeli-Palestinian situation to a just two-state solution." Launched in 1993 in the wake of the Oslo Accords, the Israel Policy Forum describes itself as centrist and pragmatic. It is both a think tank and an advocacy group. Played a prominent role in U.S.-Israeli relations through the 90s, reaching a zenith in 2001 at an event in which former U.S. President Bill Clinton detailed his parameters for Palestinian-Israeli final settlement. The influence and stature of this organization diminished in the last decade, but its current chairman, along with its executive director, David Halperin, are now leading an effort to revitalize the group, to regain some of its former stature, but most importantly, to try to create a centrist American Jewish push for peace. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rani Kedar, all the way from Israel. She was born in England, made Aliyah as a child to Israel, lived in Egypt, then lived outside of Gaza. So really quite a fascinating biography. She's very active in trying today to create an atmosphere of understanding, acceptance, and respect between Israelis and, as she puts it, our neighbors across the border, who are the Arabs primarily living in Gaza. Very active with a group called Other Voice. Welcome back. You lived in Egypt a little. You have family from Egypt. Tell us about the experience as a Jew living in Egypt.
Well, my husband is originally from Egypt, and he came to live in Israel. In fact, he says the Egyptians have evacuated him from his home twice, once in 56 in a state of war, and once in 82 for the sake of peace. When he came to Israel, he studied agriculture at the Hebrew University. And
where in Egypt was his family from originally?
From Cairo.
From Cairo itself,
from Cairo.
Okay.
And with his knowledge of Arabic and knowledge of agriculture, after 82, he was asked to go to Egypt and teach modern methods of agriculture there.
And after 82, of course, at the end of the Camp David Accords and the transfer of land,
that's
and
right.
As warm as the peace ever got with Egypt.
Exactly. And that's how he was there by himself at the beginning, very successful. We joined him as a family. We spent 4.5 years in Egypt. Now, there were 4 very educational years, both for myself and for the children. There were people we really knew nothing about except my husband's family, and yet had so much prejudice. I was suddenly confronted with talking to people, getting to know them, people who refused to come to our homes because we were Israelis, and yet by the time we left, all came to wish us farewell, and we had a very nice farewell party with all these people. With this connection and meeting these people, I realized the power dialogue can have. And if there were, like, my youngest daughter's friend, whose mother's refused, would not let her come to our house to play, and after talking a while, suddenly changed her attitude, and they became regular visitors at one another's home, I realized what could be done. If only we understand, if we start talking to people, and not always from an odd judgmental point, but trying to understand. When I came back to Israel, I looked for more people who think the way I do, which was very difficult living on the border of Gaza, being subject to attack sometimes daily, sometimes many times a day, or suffering from fear, terror of these attacks. Children growing up in trauma, grown-ups growing up in trauma.
Yeah, a lot of PTSD, they say, post-traumatic stress disorder, very high incident, a lot of people in counseling.
Definitely. And with it, so it was very difficult among these people to find those who will say, let's stop the violence, let's start talking. But it's because I live there and because I suffer so much from post-trauma, I can see that every time we attack or we retaliate, things get only worse, no better. And instead of using the time of quiet to try and get to these people and start talking, we only plan on either side how we're going to get back at them, so to speak.
So this must be somewhat controversial. You've found some people that understand that ultimately, from your collective perspective, the way to build a future is not by firing more rockets and not by more targeted killings, but by conversing, building some bounds of understanding. It must still be very controversial because of the people who are experiencing these terror attacks regularly.
It definitely is. The only difference, let's say, between me and my friends in Gaza is that no matter how controversial, people might laugh at me, might tease me, might be angry at me, but that's as far as it will go. As my friends in Gaza, if they speak their mind and they voice their other voice as we do, they're risking their lives. And that is something I have to take into consideration when many people say, oh, we are ready to do everything, we are ready to talk, it's the other people who don't. We must remember that, I think. I find that I have more and more people in Gaza who are ready to talk to us. And I also find today more and more people in Israel, around about where I live, on my particular village, in my regional council, who are coming slowly to the realization that those people are there, they're not going anywhere. And by bombing them back, even if it's retaliation, we're not going to get to our get anywhere, in fact. We're only going to make things worse. And we've got to find the opportunity. The question is, what is the opportunity? And there are opportunities. Every now and then, I think we get a wake-up call from, whether it's Abbas or whether it's Haniyeh even, from the Hamas. Every now and then, you can hear them say somewhere, we can recognize Israel as a state and move forward. Or Abbas recently in France was saying, I want to be able to go and visit my home in Tzfat as a tourist. That is something we've got to pick up on, and we don't know how yet.
So I can understand hearing certain elements in what Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the head of the Palestinian Authority, is saying. I guess I haven't heard very much from Hamas. Can you give me an example of some of the ways that those walls may be chipping away a little bit?
Every now and then you hear, there was an interview with Haniyeh, I think he was in Germany at the time, when he said, maybe there is no other way but to recognize Israel as a state. He didn't say as a Jewish state, but he said as a state. That was one incident when he went back to Gaza and he was interviewed by Al Jazeera. He said, it was a little misunderstood. I think if we had picked up on that note at the moment it occurred, it would have been more difficult for him to say, that's not what I meant. They're very small things. The recent assassination in Gaza, and I'm sorry because I've forgotten his name, he was a person who apparently had a paper from the Hamas saying that they are ready to go into negotiations. And this is it was spoken about in Israel. I think, unfortunately, it was one of the mistakes that we've made recently. Admittedly, he was connected with the kidnap of Gilad Shalit, this particular person, but he also was very much involved in the release of Gilad Shalit. And we are very good at remembering bad things people do. We are not quite so good at remembering the change in attitude and the good.
In living so close to Gaza, remembering that there was a strong working relationship and seeing what exists now, what kinds of steps can ordinary Israelis take to, besides going into bomb shelters when the missiles are coming, finding a miklat, what sorts of steps do you think as ordinary Israelis can take, and how can Americans connect to ordinary Israelis who are doing those kinds of things?
I think steps like I take, for example, or like other people in Other Voice take, in trying to meet up with people in Gaza, although it's very difficult because...
I didn't know that you could even do so.
You could. There is, from time to time, we manage to hold a seminar. We invite people over from Gaza, students. They come over 5-6 at a time. At one point, we had a big conference, and we managed to get 13 people across, and we thought it was a very big success. Hmm. In these conferences, it's amazing how much we have in common. How much points we do agree upon. Admittedly, we don't talk about who is right and who is wrong in these conferences and seminars. We don't talk about where the borders should go. We talk about issues that interest both sides and both issues that we are troubled with and we have to deal with. Another way I manage to talk to people from Gaza is by sick people do get a permit to come and have treatment in hospitals in Israel. And what I do is once a week I go to the border, it's all coordinated of course, and I take these people to hospitals in Israel. Now apart from the humanitarian act of helping the sick, it's a wonderful opportunity to sit in the car and talk for an hour and a half on the way to hospital. And we discussed many things. And one day we passed by Ashkelon. One of the men in the car said, you know, I was born here. That's my father's home was there in Ashkelon. And I said, yes, I know. But when Israel was established in a state, there were certain injustices that was done that we have to deal with. But let's look forward. I said to him, don't forget, tell your children, talk about it, commemorate, but don't let that pull you back the whole time. Start looking forward. My husband had a home in Egypt, and he was sent out of Egypt, left his home, left his father's company, everything he left behind. He never thinks of going and asking for that back. So let's look forward and start again, and I'm sure that you can get to live just a good a life as I have on this side of the border.
It's a great message. I want to thank Rani Kedar for a great visit here on Too Jewish and wish her a terrific experience in the United States. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I'm very happy to be here.
And may peace come. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help make quality Jewish education available to local students in need of financial support by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO. Here's how it works. Arizona allows taxpayers to receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized organizations like JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to children who attend local Jewish schools in Tucson. These tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you make a contribution to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit, which means that your Arizona state income tax is reduced or your refund is increased up to the amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. You have until April 15th to make your contribution for the 2012 tax year. To foster Jewish education today, give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. Or go online to JETCO.org. By making a tax credit contribution to JETCO, you help nurture Jewish identity in Tucson for new generations of students like me. And it won't cost you a dime.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be author Jessica Sofer, whose new novel is called Tomorrow There Will Be Apricots. Delicious. About, among other things, finding family. Iraqi Jews and their delicious recipes. Our playout this morning comes in preparation for the upcoming celebration of Israel's 65th birthday, Yom Ha'atzmaut, which is coming up April 16th. This is the lovely old Israeli song, Sfirat Maleh, Taking Stock, based in part on the Passover Seder song, Echad Mi Yodea, in a new format from last year's celebration of Israel's 64th birthday. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shalosh gulot v'shisha yamim v'shivah